Headliner Radio, the creative voice.
Today's podcast guest is American composer David Fleming, who has written music for film and TV, including HBO's The Last of Us, Amazon series Mr. and Mrs. Smith. He was part of the Dune 2 music team, recording arranger for Beyoncé's song Spirit for the Lion King soundtrack, and most recently composed the score for the new Netflix film Damsel, starring Millie Bobby Brown. So let's dig into these projects. Welcome on today, David. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you, Alice, for having me.
You're so welcome. Well, I'm really excited to be talking to you because, as I've just said in my intro, some of the projects you've worked on, pretty much everyone knows them. So, yeah, I can't wait to get into some of those. So I think I have to start then with, I know you weren't the composer on it. You were composer additional music, but I just saw Dune 2 in an IMAX theater, and it was incredible. And Hans Zimmer's score is, yeah, it was very loud. It was the right way to see it, put it like that. I was thinking, not that it's probably out on streaming yet, but I thought, this is not for watching at home. This is for IMAX. I wanted it to blow me out of my seat. And it pretty much did. The score, I mean, incredible. So, you know, I saw on IMDb, yeah, you're credited as composer additional music. And I know you did work on the first one as well. So what did you work on Dune 2?
Oh, God. I mean, you know, with these projects, I mean, I've worked in a similar capacity with Hans on something like 10, 15 projects. And I would definitely say like the Dune movies are kind of like the high watermark for that. And, you know, Hans always, he talks about what we do as playing in a band almost, you know, and he's always like, when the directors come in for meetings, it's like, this is the band. These are my collaborators. This is my team. And, you know, Hans is a really, he's a great person to work with in that way, because he's always about like, what is the best idea, or how can a good idea be even better? So it's very much a team atmosphere. It's very much a band atmosphere, and Hans always pushing everything and pushing everything to be as good as possible. So, yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to write music for both the first and the second film. You know, it's such an experience to be part of such a kind of boundary pushing score. I remember when we were starting the first one, it was in the middle of COVID, and right from the beginning, Hans said to me and Steve Mazzaro, who also works on the scores with us, he said, like, I don't want to do orchestra for this film. And we were like, that's great. That's really cool. I doubt that will happen because it's a big blockbuster movie.
Yeah.
But I think because A, it was a good idea for the specifics of this film, and B, because COVID sort of kind of allowed it to be even more of a restriction, we really stuck to that, and I think doubled down in the second one, where we could have gone to London and recorded a big orchestra but you know, Hans is really, he's not the type to play it safe, and that's always a fun energy to be around. And then that sort of is doubled by Denis's presence, who really is as much a part of the music team as anybody, because his taste, it just, you can see it dictate every department, the costumes and the cinematography and the music too. He has such a strong barometer for what he feels, and he never changes his mind either. That's the other thing. Some directors sometimes will go back and forth. If he feels something when he hears your cue, it's probably in the movie, you know? And even there are some times where we tried to improve things, quote unquote, and he was like, guys, we have this, you know, we have it as the first version. So, yeah, I could talk about him all day. I could talk about that project all day. It's I feel very, very lucky because it's just, I think, like a landmark film, you know.
Yeah,
both of them.
It's absolutely phenomenal. The new one in particular. I liked the first one too, but I loved the second one, which doesn't always happen with the sequel, but it's really incredible piece of filmmaking, and have you had a chance to see it actually in the cinema yet? I'm guessing you've seen it a lot before it actually hit the big screen, of course.
You know, what's funny is that I usually after I finish something, I have no desire to really watch it, at least right away. I need a bit of a break and then I can enjoy it. But for two reasons. One is we actually finished the score back in the summer, I think, like the late summer, early fall. So, and I had a couple projects in between. And then secondly, it's just, for me personally as an audience member, it's like the most appealing film. It's just right up my alley. So I couldn't wait to see it again. Yeah, I went to a cast and crew screening, which was at an IMAX, which the sound, that's why I asked about the loud, because it was so loud, but in a great way. I think it's the best mix of any movie I've ever seen, let alone worked on. And then I went to go see it again at a Dolby Atmos theater. The IMAX screen is a bit too much for me, like the size of it. But I will say, yeah, and I wasn't far back, so that was my fault. But okay. But the sound, I have to say, like the Atmos mix was really clear, but the IMAX, it was so loud, and it is that type of score that. Like the louder and the sound design, louder is better. So I really enjoyed the IMAX.
And when you watched it back, whenever that time was there a particular cue that you thought, now you had a bit of distance from the project, that worked particularly well, you know, when you saw it to picture and the final edit?
I mean, most of the score worked really well. I think some of the surprises were they had muted some of the cues in the dub, but I thought they picked the exact right cues to mute and feature the music where it really wanted to be. One cue I worked on that they really played strongly was this the cue where Fade Rautha is seduced by. Lady Fenring, and I couldn't believe just how loud the music was for a relatively like quiet scene. So that was really fun. The arena as well. The arena I expected to be swallowed up by the sound of the crowd. That's usual when you're working on a movie, like you're on a car chase, and obviously you put so much work into anything, but there is at the back of your head, like, you're never going to hear the music in this scene because it's such an effects heavy scene. And I couldn't believe the dub of the arena that, like, even though, yes, you could hear the crowds and it was big, like the music was just punched right through. So, like I said, just the most extraordinary, mix I've ever heard.
Yeah. And that was so just stylistic. Anyway, that scene, it was an infrared scene, right?
Yeah, which I didn't know until this whole press run. I just thought it was black and white, but Denis is not the type to be like bragging about how they shot something. So I've been really enjoying kind of learning about some of this stuff. It was really cool.
Yeah, I thought the fight scene between Timothy Chalamet's character and Austin Butler was incredible as well, and I can't wait to. I hope they release some kind of footage for me to dork over about the rehearsals for that. But was there music to that scene? I've only seen the film once, so forgive me, I don't remember, but that scene really stuck with me.
No, I was going to say that's what's interesting, and it bookends the first movie, because both movies, you know, they have a big climax, but then they end in like a very close-up knife fight, and neither one has music underneath. There's music in the aftermath and in the lead-up, but there's this like real high anxiety about it, I think, and partially because there is no music. It's like, it feels really like you're witnessing it, you know? Both Dune 1 and Dune 2 ended in similar fashions. I thought that was a really nice kind of parallel he drew, not just with the scenes, but with how he approached the sound of it.
Yeah, I suppose it feels exposed in a way. And just left to the sound effects of, you know, whatever's going on screen. But yeah, I totally agree. So another thing I really want to ask you about as well is The Last of Us, because that is an incredible program, which I absolutely loved, which my boyfriend was thrilled about because he's always talking about the game, but I'm just not into games. But this is my way in. This is a bit of me. It is incredible. So what can you tell me about, you know, the composing work you did for that in terms of, you know, your approach of laying the groundwork for how the this sound would, you know, sound literally, given that it's, you know, taken from a game. Did you kind of borrow anything from that, or is it completely fresh sonic landscape for you?
The answer is somewhere in between, because, you know, Gustavo's music and his musical portion for the show were all based on work he had done for the game, which is all just beautiful. And it really is, has such an identity, not just for fans, but just, you know, it worked for the show. My job was more specific in the sense that, especially because it's a new medium and that it's, you know, a game is an active experience, a TV show is passive, and there is an arc to things like action scenes, which in a game would be playable, and it's looping sort of music, and these needed to have an arc. So they needed somebody to specifically concentrate on those types of scenes. So in that way, it was fresh, but because the sort of primary material was still going to be the same of the, you know, the soundtrack Gustavo had established for the game, the goal was to make something fresh, but to have it sit next to what has already existed in this universe and will continue to, and not feel wrong next to his music. You know, the thing about his music is he has beautiful themes, yes, but he also has this real texture to his guitar playing and the way his music sounds. So the trick was for me to be able to address some of these big action scenes and kind of crazy, chaotic, nightmare fuel, but have it not all of a sudden just go into Hollywood action mode. It had to sit next to Gustavo's stuff and still feel like a distant cousin at the furthest, you know? So I wanted to be really respectful of this sonic identity he'd laid out. So for instance, like instead of, you know, playing with giant taiko drums of samples of 50 players, we recorded, you know, small single drums through an amp, just played really loud. The idea was you always wanted to kind of get a sense of what the texture is that you're playing. Is it some broken wood? Is it rusty metal? Is something very tactile, you know? Because if it was too slick and too produced and shiny, it wouldn't fit that post-apocalyptic universe that I think, you know, Gustavo's sort of broken quality serves so well. So it had, you know, the answer is somewhere in between fresh, but respectful of what had already been laid out in front of me.
Got it. And it's obviously got these such strong horror elements from time to time. So how do you kind of approach that as a composer, given there's lots of ebbs and flows in the program? It's not full on horror film mode the whole time, but, you know, in terms of maybe even avoiding cliches for horror, but you know, kind of acknowledging that there's a big part of it. It's quite a horrific thing they're up against a lot of the time.
Yeah, a lot of it was trying to figure out how to do those horror moments in a non, like you said, like a non-cliche way, like big string risers and kind of, you know, what has become. The whole idea of horror music is that there should be something about it that's unexpected and unnerving, and so much of horror films, at least in the past, you know, I think it's gotten better in the past 5 years or so, but before that there was like a decade where music hadn't, to me at least, had stopped being effective in that way, because it was sort of, you know, utilizing all these tropes, and your brain, you know, it needs to be unnerved somehow, and in that type of thing. So certainly for The Last of Us, it was trying to figure out how to not do it in typical ways. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of it had to do with the sounds that we were using, by just making rules of like, oh, well, we're not doing an orchestral score. Like this has to be handmade in the same way as everything else. And so it was a lot of figuring out how to, you know, make horrible sounds. There's a lot of bowed banjo and just like making banjo like screech. I mean, you'd never think it was a banjo, but it's just like just you know, sounds of real panic. Other things, you know, I remember there's one episode with like a little, like a child zombie, for lack of a, I know that.
Oh,
I'm
yes.
Zombie,
yeah.
A child infected, an infected child.
Yeah.
And they used samples of insects and pitched them and used them as like a synthesizer element. So, yeah, that honestly became like a big challenge for me. I didn't want it to be cheesy, or I wanted it to feel unnerving, genuinely. So I think horror films in the past couple of years have done a good job of kind of starting to delve into new musical territory and not sort of go over the same spots.
Mm-hmm. And I know there was the another episode in it. A lot of people found it quite surprising, I suppose, was that beautiful episode with Bill and Frank. I mean, apart from the people that accused the show of going woke. That's, yeah. It's not for those people, you know. It's based on a computer game, guys. Yeah, so what about, you know, that's a completely different shift, other than there was a few elements, obviously, where they did face the infected, or they were, that was sort of playing out in the background. But how was the approach for that episode?
Yeah, I mean, that's my favorite episode. It's also the one that I can take least amount of credit for, because as you mentioned, there's, you know, it's more of a self-contained love story. So it's mostly Gustavo stuff. There's a big Max Richter cue that they licensed in there as well. But even though I had you know, less to do with that than some of the other episodes, as like a fan of the show, I found it such a compelling piece of television and such a special episode. I you know, with my own sort of TV consumption, I really love, you know, I don't know if this one specifically qualifies because it was such a well done episode, but you know, in some TV seasons you'll encounter these like bottle episodes, which are usually to save money on a premiere or a finale, they'll have like an episode where two characters are caught in one location. Mm-hmm. So basically, you know, and in the past, I think it's been like those are slow episodes of TV, but I think there's been many shows like Sopranos, Breaking Bad, who have like some of their bottle episodes are their most, some of their most famous because they the restrictions allow something really special. And yes. I don't know if that was the reason for the Bill and Frank one in this case, the, you know, having a bottle episode, but it feels the same. What I feel about that is the same thing I feel about some of these other shows of, oh, okay, because of this restriction, because you've narrowed your focus, you're able to, you know, do something really different.
Mm-hmm. And are you working on The Last of Us 2? Are you allowed to say?
Don't
break an NDA for me.
No. I'm not. I hope to be. It's a little too early for the music team to be on it. But I've heard some rumblings, so that's. I'm excited for the show.
Me too, and that will justify my Now TV subscription, which I've left standing. I've just realized since now that Game of Thrones is gone, you know, what am I doing anymore? But yeah, I'm looking forward to this. But okay, final Great. Thing before Damsel, I promise. Cool. So I saw you with the recording arranger for Spirit, Beyonce's song for the Lion King soundtrack.
Yeah.
I really think this is an underrated track of Beyonce's. A lot of people say she's overrated, but I couldn't disagree.
Who says that? That is
internet
insane.
People that don't like talent. So I've been a fan of her since I've been at school. I was at Destiny's Child girl. So made my sister do the dance. I was Beyonce, obviously, because I'm older. But yeah. So, well, tell me everything, basically. What can you tell me about working on that, and if you worked with her directly at all?
Oh my God. I mean, I'm a huge Beyonce fan. I think she's honestly kind of the best thing we have going in music today. I think she's, you know, one of those people who pushes the boundaries, and it's all great, relatable music, but it's always pushing a little further. I know, you know, she's it's not the same capacity as somebody like a Prince, and that he wrote all his songs and everything, but I think in a similar fashion, I think she's chasing like the spirit animal of Prince or something, you know, the way it was pop music, but it felt really boundary pushing. So when that opportunity came up during Lion King, I was like, I couldn't believe it. I mean, basically what happened was she had written this song, and the original, and I think they were trying to figure out if it was going to go in the end credits or it was going to go in the movie. And eventually they decided it was going to go in the movie. And the song already existed and was kind of ready to go. And I was the one who needed to figure out how it was going to sort of come out of the score and back in. So she came to Hans's studio and, you know, got to meet her and she looked through the film and, you know, we found a spot that seemed like it was going to work. And basically overnight I did that. I sort of did the strings originally just as a way to get in and out of the score, but added strings and some percussion to her song in general. And then I found out she wanted to like use it for the song, which was insane. I mean, one little story I can say is that I was working with her mixer, sort of like running it by her, running it by him. And you know, I had to turn this thing over in a day, and he was in my room. He came to check it out. And she was there. She was able to come the first day, but wasn't able to come the second day. And she FaceTimed. But she was like, he was holding it, so I couldn't see her. So I was on FaceTime, and I was like talking to her. And it's that weird thing, like, you know, you can't see the person you're talking to, but you're on camera. And I was making fun of myself afterwards because she was happy with what I had done, and I was just doing gestures like holding my hands to my heart, which I've never done in my life. I was like, but she like brings it out of you because she's just, I really think she's a generational artist. And it's such a big deal to me that I got to be involved with that. And, and you know, I'm so happy she decided to keep it for the song and not just for, you know, the logistics of the film.
Oh, how incredible. And I know, she is a vocal producer. She, you know, trawls through looking for samples. She's quite involved in all these aspects of her track. So it must be good for you to know that she approved of what you did.
Yeah, I mean, one of the beautiful things about Lion King was getting to be around, and honestly, some other films like Top Gun, for instance, with Lady Gaga. But Lion King specifically, you know, getting to work with Pharrell and Beyonce directly, and these are people who are heroes of mine, you know, big musical heroes, and to have them directly involved with what you're working on. And you know, I remember, you know, making Pharrell happy with something I had done one day, and he just got so excited and came over and was just like, you know, it was just the best feeling, you know, in the world, to make somebody excited who is somebody that you look up to so much, you know?
Yeah, I mean, your job's incredible. You're hanging with Hans, Pharrell, Beyonce. I mean, when your friends ask you how was work, are you just like, it's okay, like, you know, it's fine.
I just tell them how little I'm sleeping and then they don't really care.
Yeah,
they're okay. Like, oh yeah, we don't want that.
We don't want that, no. Do you ever even get starstruck? Is there anyone that you've met that you're like, oh man, I mean, considering you're working with these tiers of people?
No, I mean, yeah, that for sure. Those people, I do. In fact, you know, there's some times where I have to remind myself of Hans and what he's sort of meant to my life before I met him. You know, now he's a friend and we've collaborated so much. But you know, he's somebody that, you know, if you had told a younger me that you'd be working with him someday, that would be like an insane dream. So. You know, I feel very lucky to be able to work with all these people. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it definitely sounds it for sure. Okay, I'm going to ask you about Damsel now. I did promise. So this is on Netflix now, obviously, for anyone listening. So this is starring Millie Bobby Brown, and it sees a damsel agree to marry a handsome prince, only to find the royal family has recruited her as a sacrifice to repay an ancient debt. She is thrown into a cave with a dragon and must rely on her wits and will to survive. And I've seen quite a few clips about this. I've seen her ripping up some stuff and, you know, climbing up these, I don't know what they are, shards of glass or something. So I haven't seen it yet, but I watched the trailer today, and Netflix is not messing around with that CGI budget, are they, for this? I mean, whoa, it looks big.
Yeah, it is big. And the dragon specifically is such an amazing piece of design, and I know they spent a lot of time on it. So much of it, when you strip away all the CGI, is really Millie Bobby Brown. It's almost like Castaway for a lot of the film. You know, it's really her in a cave trying to figure out her way out. So the CGI is amazing, but equally sort of impressive to me is that there's this like really compelling performance at the middle of it in amongst all this insane CGI, and really she shoulders so much of this film.
Because it can't just be about the CGI. It becomes sort of mind-numbing in a way with some films, not all, of course, when it's expertly applied. You've got to have the heart and the good performance. And I really like Millie Bobby Brown, so I'm sure it's going to be great. But what can you say about, you know, what were the initial conversations with the director about how they wanted Damsel to sound? You know, what kind of themes did you want to capture in this score?
Yeah, well... Before I had my first meeting with Juan Carlos, the director, I was kind of led to believe they were going to want to do something very modern with the music, in a sort of, you know, subverting the genre way, because the story itself is a subversion of the sort of typical damsel in distress story. So, you know, I thought maybe, okay, they're going to be asking me to do something that's like really modern and ironic and, you know, juxtaposed against this. But I was so surprised in my first meeting with the director, Juan Carlos. He was just like, listen, I just love the orchestra, and I want a score that has big melodies and feels timeless and really linked, like uniquely linked to our character. But he didn't want the score to be ironic or winking or commenting on it as well, you know, in any way. He wanted it. He really did want like a sincere musical identity for this character and this story and this world, which was really surprising and really kind of exciting. And, you know, I started to think of it as like, you know, approaching the score in a more traditionally orchestral way was a radical thing for me, considering, you know, some of the more sound design things that I've done lately, like The Last of Us, and to a lesser extent Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which are very modern in production. You know, quite radical for me to do something that you know, thematic and orchestral, but also kind of radical in general, you know, with this type of film. It's again sort of similarly, you know, relating to what I was saying about horror music before, is that like the subversion of the expectations, the subversion of the genre, at a certain point stops being surprising because everyone's doing it. Everyone is doing the dubstep remix of whatever the hell the score is, and then it's not. There's not surprising. So I was, you know, really excited to be able to just like boldly go into this big orchestral territory and not feel like we had to beat around the bush with it, but just be like, yeah, I mean, it's fantasy. This is a big fantasy score. And, you know, why hide from that? You know, it's just take a swing. And, you know, for me, especially growing up loving, you know, things like Star Wars and other, you know, big fantasy films, it was kind of like a childhood dream to just get to okay, you're going to go to London, you're going to record a giant orchestra, a giant choir. I mean, I'm sort of passing over like lots of little soloists and sort of interesting sounds that we added to it. But at the heart of this score, it is a large orchestral choral fantasy score with no apologies. So I couldn't have had more fun approaching it and just taking all of the governors off that that you're usually asked to put on yourself. Yeah.
Okay. And obviously I read the score is deeply connected to the characters' journeys. So tell me about the two main themes for Elodie's journey and what they represent throughout the film.
Yeah. Well, the first meeting when I presented music, I did like the stupidest thing you can possibly do, which is, you know, usually you want to have like a very well-defined main theme for your main character and say like, this is it. But I had this like nagging feeling that she needed two themes because at the beginning of the film, she's really a child. And to me, sometimes I'm accused of reading too much into the films. I know it's a big popcorn dragon movie, but I really felt strongly that this movie was like an allegory about growing up and, you know, she wants to go out and find herself in the world, but at first she has to go down into dark caves and explore what's inside and find a beast that needs to be tamed in some way. And, you know, to me, she really did have two journeys. She has this outward journey, the journey that she thinks she's going on. Okay, she's going to be a princess. She's going because her family is asking her to do this. She's a passenger to her situation at first. And she's optimistic and is looking outwards for where her life is going to go. So she had one theme that dealt with that. And then she had this other thing, this like nagging voice inside of her that was darker and more complex and is really about her internal journey and what she needs to go through and the pain that she needs to go through to find something in herself to eventually come out. And both themes do come together at the end. And I feel like she's become an adult at the end of the film and is finally able to sort of reconcile these two sides of her.
Okay. And what about the dragon theme? So this is a noticeable three-note motif that is repeated throughout the score. So how did you land on that? Were you thinking classic, you know, like Jaws kind of thing, the two notes? Where were you going with that?
No, I mean, that's the interesting thing about the dragon. And the dragon was the character that changed the most throughout the process. There were some times where, it was more beastly, and other times, you know, what they ended up with, which I think is a really interesting sort of three-dimensional character. It's really a tragic story, you know. Although she appears to be the main antagonist in the film, her story is really rooted in this tragedy of her three children being taken from her, and this horrible trauma that happens to the dragon is what it creates this obsession, leading to this ritualistic sacrifice of three princesses every generation in order to sort of, you know, fulfill this blood ritual with the dragon. So the idea was that, you know, there's many times the dragon needs to be fearsome and terrifying, but it always had to be rooted in the truth of its character, which is that at the bottom of all of this is this deeply tragic thing that happened. And the idea of the three notes came from this obsession with the three children being taken. And so for most of the film, you experience it as this sort of like brutal fanfare, these three notes that are kind of, you know, terrifying and massive. But once you start to learn more, it's presented in these three notes are presented in a totally different way, of almost like a tragic lullaby and this broken kind of, mournful tune, where you really see that at the root of all of this, and as feral and insane as the dragon seems, it really is like a wounded mother at the end of the day. So it was the most complex character to score, and you know, having these three notes and the obsession with the number three, even the rhythms are in three, it kind of allowed, by having something that simple, it allowed it to be juxtaposed over many different kind of feelings. Whereas Jaws maybe is just like, I think it's almost the opposite, is like this like cold-blooded machine almost. You know, the dragon really needed to be kind of the opposite thing, which is something that has a really deep reason for being.
Okay, that makes sense. So given the high, you know, caliber of things you seem to work on, how popular they are you working on anything else on your next project at the moment? Are you allowed to say?
Yeah, I've got a couple really fun things coming up. I just finished a documentary about Jim Henson that Ron Howard directed. Mm-hmm. And that was really exciting. Got to make like a really sort of colorful woodwind heavy score, almost, it's not jazz, but like some jazz instrumentation. And that was really fun. And currently, actually tomorrow, starting to record the score for Barry Levinson's Alto Nights, which is like a story, a true story of the mafia, starring Robert De Niro.
Oh, cool.
Actually, he's in two roles in this movie. So both of those have been really fun, and kind of continues the trend of like very, very different types of scores. You know, I mean, Last of Us and Damsel couldn't be more different, and now Henson and Alto Nights, they sort of are continuing the trend I'm really enjoying right now, where I'm like on polar ends of the spectrum. It's a fun place to be.
It certainly sounds it. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today to explain about all of these wonderful projects, David.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
All right. I'm going to let you get on with your day, but thank you so much. Would love to talk to you again in the future about one of your upcoming projects, maybe.
Sounds great.
All right. Thank you so much. Bye.
Headliner Radio, supporting the creative community.